Are you looking for your next great read, but stumped on where to find it? Let me be your book fairy godmother. When you join Rhonda with a Book on Patreon for $5 a month, I will send you a personalized book recommendation, plus my All Things Bookish newsletter every month, and give you a shout out and plug your project here on the podcast. If you're on a budget, no worries. For only a dollar a month, you can get just the newsletter, which includes exclusive content not found on the blog, and a collection of links to articles, stories, and products book nerds will love, curated by yours truly. Go to patreon.com/rondawithabook to join. Thanks so much for your support, and as always, happy reading. Good day, friends, and welcome to the Rhonda with a Book podcast, where I, Rhonda, spill the tea on books. Not literally, of course. I'm joined today for this week's reader chat by Ayana, who you may know from the Vintage Guidebook blog and social media. We, of course, talked about vintage fashion and costuming, since that is what Ayana is most known for. But since this is a book podcast, we had to bring reading into it too. You can find a full list of books that we talked about, as well as some links to some other things we discussed, at rondawithabook.com. Please enjoy this reader chat. Today I am joined by Ayana, who you may know from the Vintage Guidebook on Instagram and also on YouTube. She is a writer and content creator, and I'm so excited to get to talk to you today. How are you?
Good. How are you? I'm glad I get to talk to you as well.
Yeah. I think we've been kind of exchanging pleasantries on Instagram for a while, so nice to put a face to the name.
Always.
Yeah. So I definitely want to ask you all about vintage and historical fashion and costuming and all of that stuff. But this is a book podcast in name. So I have to ask you, what are you reading right now?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you said that, because a lot of the things that I read kind of bleed into both of those areas.
Of course, yeah.
I'm the kind of person who, I don't ever read just one thing at a time. I always have like a bunch of different books that I pick up, you know, here and there. And I actually have them with me right now because I am terrible with titles. So actually right now I have two sort of in the vein of the historical vintage Whozy Whatsits. Right now I have a reference book on Regency style fashion, so fashion in the time of Jane Austen.
Ooh, fascinating.
Yeah, no, it's so good. Like, it sounds really dry to read about.
No, I would.
Yeah, I would 100% be into that.
So good. It's by Hilary Davidson, called Dress in the Age of Jane Austen. It's fantastic. It's a picture book, so you have lots of guides and visual aids and stuff like that. It's awesome. And then I also am rereading Sense and Sensibility. I'm challenging myself to do kind of a reread, a high school reread type of thing, which is really ambitious, but... You know, you read so many things in school and you absolutely hate them because it's school.
Right.
You get out and you realize, oh no, that book was actually pretty good. So,
yeah.
Rereading all of Jane Austen.
Love it. Big fan.
Just a little bit, right?
Yeah, just a tiny bit. So I'm kind of curious if your interest in Jane Austen is kind of what led you to historical fashion, or if it was the other way around, or if they're related at all.
I think they are related. I'm not sure which came first. It's definitely a chicken and egg thing. But I've always kind of liked clothing from the past. I feel like it's much, much more flattering, I would say, just as you get older, I guess. So women of a certain age, we all have that sort of image of, who is it? The mom from Mean Girls, you know, she's got her tracksuit on and she wanted to get So I never wanted to be that. I didn't want to have to try so hard. And it just, I don't know, clothing from the past just has a certain elegance about it, I feel. And when you read lots of books from certain time periods and then, you know, watching old movies or historical period films, you see it over and over and over. And yeah, they kind of bounce off each other. The more you watch, the more you want the clothes, and the more you want the clothes, the more you watch. So,
right.
Yeah.
Kind of a catch 22 there.
Yeah, absolutely.
You said that you're rereading Sense and Sensibility. So I'm guessing you've read all of Jane Austen.
In all of her books.
Yes. In their entirety, I have read all of them except Northanger Abbey.
Okay.
But, you know, when I was a teenager, when I was in college, so now just without the pressure of being graded for them,
I'm rereading.
Yeah, I used to be an English teacher, so I read them, of course, when I was teaching them, but it's very different from reading for pleasure, so.
Oh, absolutely. How would you say that your experience of teaching classic works is different from when you're just reading it for pleasure?
I think when you're reading for pleasure, you get to be a little selfish. You get to think about what things stand out to you, what things are funny to you, people that, characters that you like. You get to think about what else is going on in the era. When you're teaching a work of literature, you're really thinking a lot about how your students will react to it. It's not... what you think is largely irrelevant.
Right.
You have to really think, what are they going to connect to it? How can I get them to connect to it? You're very much reading. It's almost like reading for a third party. You're kind of reading it on their behalf when you do
it.
Yeah.
So did you get to choose what books you taught, and kind of what was that process like?
It really depends on what kind of school you're at. Sometimes the curriculum is all chosen for you, and you know, you're doing whatever is selected. But other times, you may just have certain you know, standards that you need to meet. And if your work of literature will introduce students to those standards, you can go ahead and choose it. So most schools I found do a little bit of both. Mm-hmm. So, of course, I chose Jane as much as I could.
How did you feel that students responded? I'm sure there's like a wide range of responses, but what interesting things did you notice about their responses, I guess?
Not really a wide range, no.
Oh, really? Okay.
Most students hate it. Most students hate it. I did middle school and I did high school. I did Jane Austen with my high schoolers. Yeah, most students largely hate it, but I would say where I did see a lot of range was why they didn't like it. It wasn't
okay.
A lot of students, especially the boys, were just like, oh, this is a girl book. It's a romance.
Right.
A lot of even the girls would say, well, okay, I'm kind of liking the romance part, but like, why doesn't she just say that? Why doesn't he just tell her?
Right.
Trying to understand the social rules and etiquette of the time is, I realized very quickly that we need to have sort of a mini lesson before we can even get to the book.
Yeah, it's so different. Would you say that Pride and Prejudice was your favorite book to teach, or did you have another one?
I really enjoyed Emma.
Okay.
I really enjoyed that. Not so much story-wise, but I think the responses that I got to it, I think that one is a bit more, I don't know, maybe you can have a little bit more fun with it because the whole book is about young people sort of being mismatched in love.
And great. That's
much more readily relatable than your parents trying to, you know, interfere in your marriages.
Right.
That was a little bit harder for them to jump onto, especially the boys, you know, not even now, boys have much more, much less interference with who they're seeing and why and all of that. Mm-hmm. So I think, especially via Clueless,
Right.
It was just a lot more relatable for them. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I love Emma.
I think it's so funny. It's, I think, one of the funniest, you know, of all the big four of Austin. Mm. Yeah.
I think I could see teenagers connecting more with Emma than with Pride and Prejudice, especially from like the romance angle, because I feel like it's not as big a part of Emma. Like, it's more about her development as a character rather than who she's going to fall in love with. So,
yeah
I can see that.
It is. And it's so funny. Kids gloss right past that and go straight to, oh, this person's in love with this person, but this one.
Right.
And I'm like, but the character development.
Right. Yeah.
Two other real world books that I'm reading, though, that are not Austin.
Oh, yeah, of course.
This one is called The Dictator's Handbook.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. It's by two different authors, Bueno de Mesquita and Alastair Smith. But The Dictator's Handbook is the main title, if anyone wants to look that up. And it is exactly what it sounds like. It's just a nonfiction look at how corruption works for so long. Not in a admirable way. It's not promoting authoritarianism or anything like that. But it is talking about, you know, let's say corrupt business practices, corrupt politicians, things like that. Why are people in power who are clearly abusing it, clearly exploiting people, you know, why are they so successful?
Right.
Why isn't it an instant, you know, we won't stand for this. Why isn't it an instant takedown? Why do they have years long regimes or years long, you know, being ownership of their company, whatever it is. Right. And it's, I only started it. So not in yet, but it does do a great job of saying, okay, well, it's a very complex thing. It involves actually a lot of work on the person in power. It's not an easy job they're sitting around. And let's be honest, that's a little bit relevant for today.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly what I was thinking. Like, that feels a little too real right now.
Very interesting, because I think a lot of books tend to approach it as a very, a moral take of, you know, this is bad, you shouldn't do it because blah, 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 or going after a specific leader or specific, business owner or something like that. This is very general. So it can apply to anyone, anywhere. Yeah, it's fascinating.
Yeah, and that's so, I think that's so important for us to be aware of, you know, as citizens and as consumers, like where is that power coming from that we,
you know,
voluntarily subscribe to. So yeah, I think that's really, really important. Yeah. Very relevant.
It's good to know, just being a citizen, whatever country you're in, where, you know, wherever you are. And then to tie in with that one, I am also rereading Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry by Mildred Taylor.
Such a good one.
It's one of my favorites.
Yeah.
Yeah. I needed some levity somewhere. And for anyone listening who's not familiar, it's not exactly the lightest of books, at least towards the end, but it is told from the perspective of a 9-year-old girl. So there's a lot of fun there. And I love that it's told from a child's point of view.
Yeah.
There's so many great tangents, I feel like, in that book. You know, it's dealing with such heavy subject matter, but occasionally there's stuff like, yeah, so I got in trouble for playing with marbles.
Yeah, I remember I read that, I think, in like third or fourth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't read it since, so that's interesting.
Oh, you gotta reread it. So much.
Yeah, I should.
So that's what you're reading right now.
Yeah, it's a lot. I'm sorry.
No, that's great. I always have at least two books going at a time, too. I think that's a way that, like, I don't know if you find this to be true, but like a way that helps me like focus more on what I'm reading. Oddly, if I have something else that I can switch to, if like I'm not feeling what I'm reading, is that kind of how you experience it? Or
yes, no, I'm the exact same. After a while, I get tired of it.
Yeah.
Like, not tired of the book, but I'm just not in the mood for that particular thing. But I'm not ready to give up completely. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And you have like a good, like you have a good variety of current reads right now. So you can kind of like, you have like nonfiction, fiction, so you can switch back and forth.
Yeah. Yes.
Totally makes sense to me.
I'm glad it's not to me. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, totally. I think that's also, you know, something that when we were messaging the other day, how we were talking about how like in with the current state of the world right now, I think a lot of people find it difficult to focus on, I mean, particularly on reading. So yeah, I totally see that.
Whatever you're in the mood for, you can just shuffle out a new book. Exactly.
Right. So I am kind of curious, going back to Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry, was that one of your favorites when you were a kid?
Yeah, I absolutely loved it as a kid. It's common school reading, you know, like you were saying too, but I loved it just in and of itself. I read it so quickly and I read it again and again, even as a kid. Into adulthood. So it was one that stuck with me even after school. I think it's just such a, you know, from a literary standpoint, just a wonderfully written book. The way that I think Taylor tells a story, yeah, from a child's point of view, but outside of narration, outside of dialogue, it's very mature. And I think that was balance, because I think you need that for the levity again of such. It's about a family in the 1930s in Mississippi, sorry for reference for anyone, which is automatically so fun. Great Depression is already a winner, like that's,
oh yeah,
you already know it's gonna be happy.
A lighthearted romp.
exactly. And it's just so beautifully written, and I think captivating. She does a great job also of, I think, getting that that country dialogue just right, that, you know, African-American vernacular and from Mississippi. Like, that's where my grandparents are from.
Okay.
The middle of Nowheresville in the South. And that's exactly how they sound when they're talking to their other old friends. And it's so amazing to me to... you know, I didn't grow up like that, but immediately reading this book, I can think, oh, okay, this is exactly how things would have sounded like that. That's exactly how, my grandparents sound, their friends sound. So perfect, even though, she herself, I think, wrote it in the 70s.
Yeah, I just Googled it. It was 1976.
So, yeah. Right? So that's amazing.
So I wonder if she was like capturing her own childhood. I'm sure that's what probably inspired that. Yeah, I think this book, I feel like this book is also just so relevant for right now.
Yeah.
With, you know, everything that is kind of coming to the surface once again with, you know, racial tensions in our country and people who are, you know, pushing for social change. So
yeah.
I definitely want to reread this.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Please reread it. And it's sad that you could read this and it's not. Sadly, this could still have happened. Everything that happens in the book in like 2020, it's beautiful, sad in that way that, you know, not too much has changed. But I think, like you were saying, in a way that makes it all the more relevant, you know, that's so.
Yeah.
And I love too how Taylor has so many different characters, and that's, I think, so hard to do. You know, everyone kind of makes fun of Game of Thrones, George R. R. Martin, you know, so many characters, right? But it's really hard to pull that off. It's really hard to get the characters down, so many different personalities. And I love that her characters are complex, you know, they're not all one thing, all not. And that's human. That's very human.
Well, I'm definitely going to find a copy of it as soon as possible.
You've convinced me.
Yeah.
What were some of your other favorites when you were a kid?
I think, again, to tie in with that love of history and the past, I love the, and I may be showing my age here, the Dear America series.
Yes, I love those too.
Major nerd here, but I loved it. I read as many as I could from my library. I tried to buy as many as I could. I thought they were all, I loved all of them. There was no real preference or anything. I was just so captivated by fictional firsthand account of different periods in history, and not like in particular, just what was life like at, you know, during this time, during that time, for that kind of person. Like, I thought those were wonderful.
Yeah, those were great. I loved those. Did you ever read the American Girls
books? Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course you did.
Card carrying number here. I read pretty much most of the books from the original 90s lineup, all those characters. Of course, wanted all the dolls. Of course, my parents said no. These are
Same.
I did get one, but yeah, love those series as well. I was definitely a 90s kid. That was Bumps, The Babysitter's Club.
Yes.
But I did read lots of adult books as well. I did, my parents got me all those, you know, childhood abridged versions of you know, the Western classics. And I did read those. And then when I got a little older, I wanted to read the originals, stuff like that. So I was that weird kid in, I think, fifth grade with reading Little Women because someone got it, you know, a raffle or whatever. And I traded someone like a piece of candy for a book. And the girl was like, "You really want to do this trade?" And I was like, "Yes." Can't wait to read it. She was like, "Okay, I'll just take the Snickers."
Yeah, I love Little Women too. I think that one's kind of it's one of those books that, like, you read it as a kid and it's just like fun.
Yeah.
And then you read it as an adult and you realize, kind of like with Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry, like, you realize all of the serious stuff that's in there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's one of those books that you can read at any stage of your life. That kind of grows with you. Like, I imagine if I were a parent with four girls, I would read Little Women very differently. Absolutely.
So do you have a TBR list?
Oh, my gosh. and it's like 3,000 long. One of my friends just got me into Goodreads, literally like this past.
Oh.
I'm so late. I can't believe it. But it's amazing to keep all the books in one place. You know, your library or wherever you buy your books, you can do a wish list or something like that. But it's not the same as having everything in one place to be read, the books you have read, books you want, your wish list, like all these different versions or whatever. It's amazing. I think the last time I checked, it was like 300 something deep. So,
right.
But to be fair, a lot of those books are sort of reference books for fashion and stuff like that, sewing books.
Right.
So they're not text heavy, but there's a lot of them.
So for someone who is maybe like just beginning with like historical fashion or with sewing or costuming, do you have like a book that you would recommend to get them started?
I think there's one of two ways that you can kind of look at it. If you are definitely not into, I would say not into the history of it at all, you just want kind of a sewing guide. For that, I definitely think the Kyoto Museum has a great, the Kyoto Fashion Institute, they are a great reference. They have, they've made several different editions. Any of them are fine. They're a great book. They go from about the 1700s up to the 1990s.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. And it's purely reference. So it's literally just pictures and captions. That's it. So if you're first getting started, you just want to know, like, okay, what is the difference between 1880s, 1870s? That's something a lot of people who say, well, I love historical dress, but like, I can't tell the periods apart yet.
Right, right.
I think that's a great place to start. But I think if you want a little bit more of the history behind it, and like I said, I've always been fascinated about the world in certain times, not just the clothing. I'm definitely interested in like what was going on. Why did people like certain clothing in certain eras? You know, why did something come about in one era and then, you know, why did it fade out in another one? Stuff like that. I definitely recommend The Lost Art of Dress. I can't remember the author just now, and I'm so sorry, but The Lost Art of Dress is one of the best books. I think it might be one of my favorite books of all time.
Wow.
It's so fascinating. It just talks about the history of modern dress, at least in America. It doesn't speak to any other countries, I'm sorry, but it sort of discusses how when women finally... It does address men a little bit too, but focuses mainly on women. When they first were able to have more than, you know, maybe two outfits a week, suddenly have this myriad of choices. What are you with? You know, for most women throughout history, that wasn't really a question you had to worry about. You only had two clothes, you know, two dresses, one for Sunday and one for the rest of the week that you just wore to death, you know?
Right.
Easy choice. But suddenly with more wealth, even, you know, in marginalized families and stuff like that, you still had enough clothes for, you know, maybe a few a week. That does present choices. And I think anyone who's ever been to a uniform school kind of understands that it is a lot easier to get dressed when you only have one, maybe two choices.
Right.
But suddenly when you don't, what do I wear becomes this huge overarching question, because of course clothing then as now does show something to you, to the world. Certain colors and shapes can make you look your best or your worst, you know, and not even a size thing, but just certain colors on certain people look better, look worse, look, there's so many choices, right? And it talks about how when women were faced with those choices, it's not an innate thing. That style is not, you know, fashion is just what's coming out every year, what's, you know, on the hanger, or even if you're making your own clothes, what's what fabric is in the shops, sure. But style is so closely related to art. That's what the book discusses, and how it can be learned, it can be taught. It's not something innate that some people have style, some people don't. People would like to say that. But they were saying, yeah, it's not an innate trait. It's just understanding, yeah, color, shape, movement. And it talks about how previously it was much easier when you had fewer choices. Or, you know, if you were one of the wealthy, you had someone else picking out all your clothes and they could make those choices for you. But now when you're making your own, it's much more of a conundrum to try to figure out. And it talks about how women were taught to do that by various seamstresses, domestic science, or, you know, what we call now home ec, or call then home ec. It's so interesting. It's crazy to me how, yeah, now everything is so pre-chosen for us, you know,
right,
that we don't make our own clothing. In a way, something's a little lost there. Like, we got the convenience, but, you know.
Yeah. Well, and I think there's also, I'm not sure if this particular book goes into it, but there's also something to be said for, like, sustainability
and
being, like, environmentally conscious in you know, how we choose our clothing now versus how it was chosen in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. It touches on it a bit, but it does sort of, there's a whole chapter on thrift. I think that's actually the name of the chapter, and talks about how, let's say in the 1920s, you would be picking, because, you know, you can only wear so much as you can make. So unless you kind of just be sitting around sewing, you know, hundreds and hundreds of pieces for yourself, you're limited by time, your own energy, your own money, right? In a way that we're today. And it talks about how, yeah, you could make a wardrobe for maybe a week or two, something like that. And it wasn't expected that you would have more than that, because, of course, no normal woman has that kind of time to sit and just sew and sew and sew.
Right.
Yeah. And it does talk about, you know, such a comparison to now, where you might buy a new outfit a week, not even, you know, you're not trying to get through a whole wardrobe in a week. You're buying new ones every week. And so clothes were much more a mix and match back then. The question of, oh, I don't want to get this, but it doesn't match anything that we have now, was less of an issue back then. And yeah, I think it just does such a great job of, it does go into the art principles, and it does teach you how to have style in what you're wearing. Just spoiler alert. But it also talks about, yeah, the history of the why. Why do we think that now? What did people think then, and why did they think that? Some things are very different from now, and some things are exactly the same. It's so funny. How, you know, over time, some things never change. And one side note, and then I swear we can move on.
Oh, no. I find all of this, like, really fascinating. So, like, you're...
I never want to, like, out-nerd myself. So thank you for saying that. but it talks a lot about utilitarianism in clothing, and how clothing in the past decades, this is about turn of 20th century, by the way. So it doesn't really go behind that, because that was about the time when people were becoming more prosperous in American society and being able to have more than, like, yeah, those 2-3 outfits a week. So it goes from about the 1900s up through now. It talks a lot about how most patterns, sewing patterns, or even if you were splurging and buying something in a store, things would always come with, like, a matching jacket. The idea of not having a jacket with a dress was like, what?
And right.
What if you get cold? common issue, right? Everyone has the AC down way too low in offices, in schools, in you know, malls, and you're always having this thing of, okay, well, what if I'm cold? Then I have to find something that matches this. I have to find something that, you know, is still work or school appropriate. What if it has trim on it? What if it's not, you know, it's dry clean? Like, you have all these questions, right? Because you're trying to pair one jacket, one sweater, whatever, with your one dress, then your tops, then your bottoms. Back in the day, you bought a dress and you bought a jacket with the dress, and they went together, and you expected that they could mix and match. So that you see a lot of neutrals. You see a lot of navy, gray, browns, creams, things like that, because they'll match everything in your wardrobe, and they'll also match each other. And sewing patterns, even if you did it in another color, it was expected that, okay, you're going to buy 2 bolts of fabric and you're going to make tops and bottoms with just these 2 bolts, so you can constantly mix and match. You'll never be without a jacket to your to your dress to, you know, whatever it is. And mm-hmm. I mean, look at when you go to prom or something like that. Your dress freezes if you're freezing.
Yeah. And you have to get like a little shawl or something, and
it doesn't.
Yeah.
Do you make a lot of your own clothing that you wear, like just for every day?
I'm starting to.
Okay.
Kind of how I was saying, The Lost Art of Dress does mention that it takes a lot of time to sew your own clothes, not the individual piece itself. You know, some things are easier than others to sew, but just to sit down, do it to completion, make sure everything fits properly. That's a big thing they talk about in the book, is that fit is the number one important thing, and having your clothes look good that we've lost from today, in today, off the rack. And it takes a long time to get it just so. I mean, it's so worth it. But having something that fits you exactly the way you want. But I just recently haven't had the time.
Sure.
Yeah. And I think as horrible as, you know, coronavirus and 2020 have been, I would say a silver lining to it is we have all been forced to stop and have more time at home.
Right.
Or for worse. So I finally, yeah, I can't. It's not the best idea to be going anywhere, right? We're supposed to stay home if possible. And that's been great for sewing. So
yeah.
You have a lot more time. Yeah. Yeah. So I'm definitely starting to make more, definitely starting my historical costuming journey more. It's been great in terms of crafting. So.
Sure. Time period would you say, like, what, like the fashion that you gravitate toward most?
Oh, definitely 1940s.
Oh, okay.
Definitely. Nice. Maybe 40s, 50s, 60s, early 60s for sure. But 1940s, I think, is the most wearable. For just for reference, 1950s is definitely more things you would see on, you know, maybe I Love Lucy. 1960s, early 1960s at least, is definitely like, if you watch Mad Men, they do it to a T.
Right.
Perfect.
Yeah.
God. But the 1940s, I feel like, gets left out so much. I guess because it's war, people think it either looks just like the 50s or it's just really boring. Everyone's just kind of wearing suits and maybe their nurses' uniforms. But it's really wearable. It's a lot of button downs and just A-line skirts. And I think A-line is very hard to find today. Everyone does pencil.
Yeah. And
you can find a lot of mini skirts. You don't have a lot of skirts with movement that aren't poofy circle skirts with a lot of volume. Those are beautiful. But if you're talking about just practical, you want something that's sort of in between. You don't want too much volume because that can get caught on things and, you know. That's, I don't know. It's so beautiful. So utilitarian. High-waisted pants. For anyone, like, I don't know. Yeah, like you were saying, for introductions, for fashion, there's a few shows that were on Netflix or used to be. Bomb Girls and Land Girls.
Okay.
Two shows that are floating somewhere on the internet that are really good for 1940s fashion.
Okay.
Yeah. And that, you know, like you were saying with like the practicality of the skirt shapes and everything, like that makes sense because, you know, the 1940s, like it was the war time and like everyone's resources were limited and they were having to do, you know, different daily activities than they had before. So that makes sense that it would be much more wearable.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I think it's one of the most wearable periods.
Yeah, I actually really love 1940s
style as well.
So yeah, no, I'm right there with you. Especially like the hairstyles from 1940s, like the victory rolls and yeah. Mm-hmm. I just think it's so pretty, but in like a practical way.
For guides online too, for like, yeah, visual aids, definitely check out The Ultimate Fashion History. It's as of right now posted on YouTube. It's done by a fashion, I don't want to get the university wrong, but done by Amanda Halle, who at the time was recording, I believe, her lectures at a fashion fashion history, art history, don't quote me on that.
Okay.
But yeah, she goes through different centuries, different decades of time, and it's just her lectures. So, I mean, they're all referenced and stuff like that. And also Crow's Eye Productions on YouTube has a series called Getting Dressed.
Yeah.
And they do different eras and stuff like that. And these are all for Western history, Western fashion history, unfortunately. I'm still looking for guides for non-Western dress. I think that's one area that is painfully ignored, you know? And I think,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, other people have posed too.
Yeah. It wasn't just Europe and North America. Yeah, totally.
But yeah, just to get started, those are two great places that have lots of visual guides, visual aids. Yeah, as well as books. I'm always on the hunt for books, and that's why I'm so glad Goodreads, because, you know, they recommend more. Such a rabbit hole.
Yes, totally. Yes. Goodreads will suck you in.
No, it's great. It's fantastic. But always looking for books, because sometimes, well, you know, the obvious, we all get tired of looking at screens. I think especially now we're all looking at computers way more. But also nice to have a good picture book, I think. There's something, I think, to be said for that. So I'm always on the hunt for that. I do have a Pinterest under the same name, the Vintage Guidebook, with some books. I'm going to try to have more fashion history books because, yeah, reading Hillary Davidson's book about Regency fashion has made me realize, like, I love seeing the explanation of a piece with that piece. And I understand reference books are so expensive because you're talking, you know, color illustrations,
right?
Photos in some cases. I get it, but it's so worth it if you can get your hands on one or even from the library, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a big fan of libraries.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, this is such a great time, I think, to talk about reading. Like I was saying
before. Yeah, yeah, totally.
Yeah, the only good thing, you know, this has been such a horrible event. I don't want to make light of that at all. I do think a good thing that has come from it is, yeah, I think it forced everyone, especially, you know, in wealthier countries, which have problems with stress and anxiety and things like that. I think it kind of forced everything to slow down and stop. So I don't know about anybody else, but I'm absolutely loving having time to read, having time to read. You know, anyone asks you to go out, you're like, can't do it. You know, not recommended, guys. So
right.
I get to stay home and read. And yeah, I'm working through my TBR list, works in progress as far as sewing. And the intersection of the two, I think, is so much so much closer than one might think, in a way that, kind of, you were saying, we don't have now, as far as, you know, especially with clothing and sustainability, there is definitely a disconnect from what you're doing, what you're buying, and the end product.
Right.
And I think reading definitely makes you more aware of that. Making your own clothes makes you more aware of that, that we're all more connected to each other than we think.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, for better or for worse.
And yeah, we need each other.
Yeah.
We do.
So important and so gratifying, I think, to finish a book, to finish an item of clothing is so much more gratifying than you know, that quick fix, you know. Mm-hmm. It seems like almost a million years ago since I've been to a mall, but we can all remember how that used to go. You just pop in, go to Forever 21, you know, get something, and you don't even think about it. And I think it's the same way with reading. You have to be so much more mindful with reading. Everything stops. Literally, your hands stop. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're doing, you know, an audiobook or something, that's a little bit different. But that feeling of turning the page, everything around you just goes away. Mm-hmm. I think it's really a good thing that we're able to kind of get back to that.
Would you ever consider writing a book?
Yeah. Oh, wow. I can't believe I didn't mention any.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So I know you've written like blog posts that are fantastic.
Thank you.
Would you ever write about that kind of topic or any other kind of topic?
I would love to write both. I have stopped and started a novel for quite a while, and for the same reasons I've been saying. You know, life has a way of speeding things up. You don't have time for anything, let alone, you know, something that is more of a hobby. It's been so hard to just get back to writing, especially mm-hmm. when it's a larger thing. And I mean, I love novels. I think that's maybe my favorite form of literature. Nonfiction, I think, is great, especially when written well, because it can read like people, so I'm kind of cheating. But they're my favorite. You get absolutely lost in the world and the characters, and you know. So I am working on a novel. I would love to say that it'll be finished soon and you know, up with me for updates, but again, with the time, you can only do so much.
Yeah.
And another thing about time is that it also teaches you focus. It's better to do one thing at a time, finish it, than so many different things, and you never end up completing anything. So I'm trying to, you know, I'm guilty of it as well. So I'm
trying to
teach myself, okay, maybe finish this one thing and then you can move on to another thing. But I am always writing. I'm doing my blog. Mm-hmm. I'm a guest contributor on a historical fashion blog. I will sometimes write freelance pieces. I mean, right now I have, you know, little bits of my work kind of all over the internet. Mm-hmm. I don't have anything independently as yet, but I am working on it. Writing is such a labor of love. It's such a wonderful thing. It's so ongoing.
Yeah.
Yes.
So yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And for any listeners curious, I will have links to some of Ayana's blog posts on my blog post.
Yeah, right now, just with everything going on, and I think as much as we all have more time and stuff like that, I think let's also sort of acknowledge the elephant in the room. This isn't a vacation where we have all this. Mm. It's a very emotionally taxing time.
Right.
I think especially if you're in America, we don't just have the pandemic. We have all these lovely other things.
Yes.
So, you know, I don't think anyone is quite at peace and just kind of like, oh, yeah, well, this will be a great time to. No, we're all kind of struggling through.
Yeah.
So every day I try to just take it as it comes. Some days are wonderful writing days and I have so much that I just put out there. But you know, some days are not, and I think it's okay to give yourself those days where it's okay if you don't do anything. It's okay. And I've been giving myself some of those. I think we all should be kind to ourselves.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I do have, you know, pretty much everything I've ever done linked all over the place. So yeah, we can just all be on this journey together.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just once again, thank you so much for joining me today. This was such a delight. I really love all of your Instagram content, so it's really great to get to actually talk with you. This is great.
No, it's good to talk to you too. I'm glad that we were able to do this and yeah, just talk about books and clothes, and it's all related, all of it.
Yeah,
totally. I think I mentioned this already, but do you want to plug all of your places where people can find you?
Yeah.
Just to make sure we get everything.
What else is the internet for?
Yeah,
I am known as the Vintage Guidebook pretty much everywhere on social media. I have a blog. I have all of the big three, you know, your Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. I am definitely more active on Instagram, though. Mm-hmm. My younger followers, I'm an old lady, secret, but has promised to show me how TikTok works. So,
oh, yes.
I want to get into that, but as of right now, not yet. Just started YouTube, but yeah, I'm keeping all the handles the same, so no issues there. Fan fiction, I do have some really terrible fan fiction that I can link. You know, we all just want to read some trash online.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But also for anyone listening who writes, fan fiction is a great way to just get practice and mm-hmm. you'll get some free feedback without having to worry about someone stealing your work, because you are kind of stealing the idea from the author in the first place. So it's
right.
It's wonderful. Don't knock it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love fan fiction.
Yeah, it's bad, but
such a, yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. well, thank you so much again, Ayana. I will hopefully be able to catch up again soon.
Absolutely. You too. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you so much again to Ayana for joining me today. You can find a full list of Ayana's recommended books and links to her work online at rondawithabook.com. That's also where you'll find more of my bookish thoughts, and you can get exclusive Ronda with a Book bonus content through my Patreon. You can also follow me on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. Thank you so much for listening. And as always, happy reading. Are you looking for your next great read, but stumped on where to find it? Let me be your book fairy godmother. When you join Ronda with a Book on Patreon for $5 a month, I will send you a personalized book recommendation, plus my All Things Bookish newsletter every month, and give you a shout out and plug your project here on the podcast. If you're on a budget, no worries. For only $1 a month, you can get just the newsletter, which includes exclusive content not found on the blog, and a collection of links to articles, stories, and products book nerds will love, curated by yours truly. Go to patreon.com/rondawithabook to join. Thanks so much for your support, and as always, happy reading.